Welcome to the Funtime Program. I'm your host, Vivica Volt, and this is my co-host,
John Andrew Fredrickson.
And today we have a very special guest, Dr. Logan Levkoff. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Obviously, we want to talk about some of your books, but I want to start with virtual sex ed.
Virtual sex ed. Yeah, so I should probably say I am a sexuality educator. Mm-hmm. I have been for a really long time in a non-professional sense since the age of 15 when I was a peer HIV and AIDS educator in my hometown in the early 1990s.
Wow, yeah. Where was that?
In Long Island.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So, and it was this, you know, in hindsight, it was this really incredible blip in time when even if no one's parents or families or schools had ever talked about sex before, because mm-hmm. there was this you know, HIV and AIDS epidemic, people stepped up to the plate and started talking about condom use and protection, and partially out of desperation, but the stakes were really high. So, you know, there are parts of my generation that got this, you know, amazing, if not limited, information back then. And then, of course, I've been working as a professional sexuality educator for the last two decades.
That's awesome. So cool. Oh. First of all, I love talking about sex and all things sex education. So I'm just very excited.
Good. I'm so glad. I mean, I feel like people exist on one of two sides of this debate. They love sex ed, or, you know, they think that we are evil out to, you know, ruin children for the rest of their lives.
Yes. Yeah. You know, if ruining children means giving them competent sex education, I think I'm fine with ruining these children.
I know. We have different definitions of the word ruin for
yeah,
some reason.
Exactly.
I mean, if you don't teach sex ed, kids turn to porn, and porn is not sex ed.
For sure. And I remember sex ed for me in school, and I'm sure a lot of other people have had a similar experience. It's pretty awkward as a kid. You don't really know, you know, it's stuff that you don't really talk about with your peers. You're just learning to kind of talk about it with your peers. But then this adult comes in and starts talking about these things that you don't really know anything about. And you're sitting with your peer group and it's kind of awkward. And you just posted on Twitter recently that you've had this experience where, you know, one of the few things that's happening in the pandemic is that we're all learning to use this digital technology in Zoom. And it's all of a sudden being able to do sex ed where the children or the young adults, I guess, are in, you know, the comfort of their own homes. That they're able to have a very different experience with sex ed. What has that been like?
So it's really interesting. Virtual sex ed, you know, comes with amazing opportunities, but also comes with challenges and accessibility issues. So I don't want to say that it's perfect, because clearly virtual education is far from perfect.
Of course.
Right.
That being said, you know, there are some really interesting moments where dynamics that take place in a classroom, particularly with children and adolescents who maybe are uncomfortable, maybe you're trying to figure out who they are, who are looking to their peers to either validate their reactions in some way. You know, this levels the playing field a lot, because if I'm taking sex ed online, I'm not looking at the person next to me who maybe is, you know, more popular than me in a classroom, who I'm looking at thinking, if I ask this question, if I raise my hand, if I smile, what are they going to think about me?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's been really interesting. It takes out a lot of that, in my experience, a lot of that peer pressure dynamic. Now with teenagers, that doesn't mean they don't use the chat box, but,
of course.
But in terms of participation, it feels like it's changed.
That's awesome. So what age do you think is the great age to start kids with sex education? And like, what type of sex education do you think you should start kids with?
It's a great question. My answer is birth.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I personally agree with that too. Like, I mean, if you just normalize talking about sex, it doesn't become this weird, taboo, scary thing.
Interesting. So what does that mean then? In terms of like the early ages and their exposure to sex talk.
Yeah. So I think that we get tripped up on this idea that talking about sex means talking about how to have sex and mm-hmm. different types of sex and where you put certain body parts, which seems ridiculous.
Right.
You know, I like to think of this conversation about sexuality as literally something that we have from birth to death. I mean, it is the core of who we are. I mean, sure, it includes at some point our sexual feelings and desires and our sexual orientation, but it also is about how we identify and express our gender, body development, our body image and our self-esteem as it relates to our bodies, the roles we communicate and how we operate in relationships, even friendships, gender roles. There's so much to it. And if we stop looking at it as, you know, putting certain body parts in certain places, we start to realize that it's something that we're figuring out all of the time. So when I say sex ed begins at birth, and I say it acknowledging that I have teenagers of my own who have actually been the recipients of this sort of philosophy. You know, it's meant that we've always talked about correct terms for body parts. We always encourage them to look at lots of different types of families and family structures. We never hid how pregnancies could be created. We allowed them to play with toys and wear clothes and have hairstyles that were beyond what was expected of them. And right. I think that all of those things lay the groundwork for a really healthy sense of yourself and equally as important, respect for those who might be different than you.
Yes. Yeah, that's so wonderful.
Oh, I completely agree. I think that's such a great philosophy. And I come from a super repressed background. I was taught abstinence only sex education and still lost my virginity at 13. Whole ridiculous thing. So now as an adult, I'm like, yeah, no, if we just teach kids from like an early age, like here's what you should expect. When I got to go visit my friend or my family down in Belize, I took a bunch of like the New York City free condoms that they give. Like I took a big bag of them and I gave some to my 16-year-old cousin. And then I also gave some to my uncle because he has 15 kids. And I was like, yeah, you know, sir, it looks like you did not have the right sex education. Let me show you how this condom works.
And I love that because, I mean, my kids, I've worked with the Trojan condom brand for a long time as you know, in the spirit of full disclosure on their sexual health advisory council. So ever since my son is almost 16, ever since he was born, I get a lot of products that are sent to our apartment all the time. So, you know, we used to open them together and like thousands of condoms would spill out. And we had so much fun talking about them and thinking about them, not so much in terms of sex products, but mm-hmm. that they're actually health products, right? It's a symbol of respect and responsibility. And the sooner we can change that framework, as opposed to thinking of them as something that makes you not trust your partner or that there's something wrong with you or your sexual health.
Right.
You know, I think the better off we are. And I think, Vivica, to your point earlier, also this idea that when we talk about sex, we're also talking about our body's capacity for pleasure mm-hmm. and masturbation and not necessarily just about partners, but figuring out who you are and what you can do on your own.
I love that. I love, though, the way that you just phrased that about how sexual protection is about health. And it's about caring about your partners, and not just caring about yourself, but caring about your partners. How do you think the pandemic has change people's perspectives on how our own personal health decisions have effects on other people around us and people that we care about? Because it's been so interesting how living, you know, a sexually free lifestyle, you have to worry about like if you're protecting yourself, because then the next partner you sleep with, you have to be protecting them as well. But it's only people you're sleeping with. Now here's the pandemic. And it's like, if I'm not protecting myself by wearing a mask and socially distancing, and then I go home and visit my family, I'm exposing my family to things that previously I'd only be worried about exposing sexual partners to. And it's like, I think that people who maybe haven't lived more of a sexually liberated lifestyle are now more aware of this idea that we are so interconnected in our own personal health decisions, whether it comes to choosing whether to vaccinate or not. I grew up not vaccinated until my adult age, and having to like study this and learn, well, why do we vaccinate ourselves? You know, are we just worried about our own selves and whether or not we're going to be exposed? Or are we worried about our contribution to the greater health of our community? And do you think that the pandemic is changing people's perspectives on that in a way that maybe will have a positive impact on their sexual health decisions?
I sure hope so. The pandemic has really highlighted what most of us who were sexuality educators or public health educators have really talked about for a long time, right? Having these conversations about risk, you know, what we are willing to take risks on, what we're not, how to navigate protection, how to navigate a partner, a friend, a parent who, you know, who may have contracted something, and how does that impact our choices and how we communicate with that person, especially if we're sharing our bodies in some way. So I think that we've been practicing this for a long time, but as we know, humans have trouble with conversations they perceive to be awkward.
Yes,
you know, it's the one thing, it's the thing that I've seen so much of in the last 5 years with my students. So I have the sheer privilege of being able to work in a lot of different schools, you know, whether it's co-ed or single sex or gender, religious, secular, you know, kids who have learning disabilities, specialized schools, that a lot of different places and a lot of different age groups. And thing that has become abundantly clear, and I do think that social media has played a role in some way in it, is that we have this perception that the way in which we communicate and express ourselves in a sexual or romantic way, it has to be perfect and cool and smooth, because so much of life seems to be manufactured and everything looks so filtered and lovely,
right,
that they're so concerned with asking questions, whether it's about consent, whether it's about pleasure, whether it's about, you know, have you ever been tested for an STI or tested positive for an STI? They're so consumed with saying these things, but not being awkward. And I fear that awkward has become a bad word instead of recognizing that vulnerability has always been a part of sex and sexuality, and that's okay. And there's a lot of value in being awkward and getting past it and teaching us resilience. But that's hard for a lot of people to navigate.
That's so amazing. And that's so wonderful, because I love the way you talk about it, you know, being this lifelong journey, right? It's like, if you normalize these kinds of otherwise awkward discussions, and even if you're not necessarily having a conversation with a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old, they hear people talking about it in a way where they recognize that, like, maybe it's a little awkward, but it's much less awkward than if it's never talked about. And all of a sudden you're 13 years old or whatever, and it's like, now we're going to have to talk about the birds and the bees, and this is just as awkward for me as it is for you. So let's just do it and get it over with, and we'll never talk about it again. You know what I mean? It's like, the more people, the children are exposed to just the fact that this is happening and people are talking about it, and eventually they're going to talk about it and it'll be a part of their lives. I think that reduces the awkwardness, and that's why that's so important. I love, though, the way that you talk about social media and how that's kind of influencing every aspect of you know, our identities, the way we interact with each other. But of course, now with these teens growing up in the social media world today, you have this incredible book, which we absolutely have to plug. We actually got 2 copies of it. We've been reading it over the past week. It's called Got Teens, and we're going to put this up on the screen so that people can see it better. And we'll put a link in the description as well. Got Teens, The Doctor Mom's Guide to Sexuality, Social Media, and Other Adolescent Realities. How has social media played a role now in this ever-changing world of teenagers coming of age and learning how to build their identities and embrace themselves and interact with the world and each other in new ways as adults?
That's a huge question with not a simple answer.
Which is why we have the book.
and by the way, I don't know if one book can solve all those issues either, or answer all of those questions, because even when that book was written, it's a few years later, the landscape has changed, how people use social media, how people identify and express themselves, and the words that we use even to describe or identify gender have become so much more expansive. So I think there's constant evolution, but social media, depending on how we use it and also depending on who we are when we engage with it, can be wonderful or really detrimental, quite frankly, in a lot of ways. You know, I think that using social media to find a community that reflects who you are, to know that there are other people like you, is so incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
You know, I think back to growing up in the 80s and 90s where there was none of that. And if your sex education was fairly heterosexist and just limited in general, this idea that there were people like you would have been incredibly empowering and really probably would change the people's trajectory in terms of how they interacted with others, how they took care of themselves, self-esteem. So I think that that's incredible, that you can find your community. Of course, this idea that you have to define yourselves in these little moments, that they have to be perfect and witty, I have a very good family friend who is a teenage daughter who's like another child of mine. And I remember the year that she told me that she couldn't post a certain Instagram photo. She couldn't do birthday posts because it didn't match with the rest of how her page was laid out. Yeah. And it had to be a certain color scheme. And I just thought,
oh, she was why are we doing this? Yeah. Yeah.
Especially like if people in your life are going to like you less because of the post that you put and it doesn't match the rest of the page, then honestly, the people you're surrounding yourself with are assholes. Yeah. And right. I think that's right. That's always been what I tell my kids. So I have an almost 16-year-old son and my daughter is almost 12. And one of the things I always say is, you know, my social media and for them too, should be a way that you want to express and reflect yourself. It shouldn't be about how you're going to be validated by other people. Right, you know, yes. I post things to tell my own story so that mm-hmm. I can look back and see my own narrative.
Right.
I mean, I really don't care about what anyone else has to say.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not doing it for the likes.
But that's so hard as a teenager because you haven't yet developed your identity. And now kids are using social media to develop their identities. And it feels so important at that age that you get it right. Because if you get it wrong, you become an outcast. Or, you know, our ideas of like screwing up at that age when it comes to identity and your peer group, it feels fatal almost. Like yeah. your life will be over if you don't get it right. You know how it is when you're yes. at that age. So it's like.
I'm certainly not minimizing that. But I think that part of that, you know, I think that there are certain things in my perfect world. You know, before we give young people access to technology and social media, and I'm not saying that there's a particular age in which that like is a magically great decision, mm-hmm. but I think that there's so many conversations that can take place before about, you know, developing your identity, respecting other people, healthy yeah. relationships, healthy friendships, so that if someone responds to you in a negative way, you know, you have the tools to say, you know what, that person does not have my best interest at heart. And that's not the person who I should be putting on a pedestal in terms of their, you know, their opinions of me.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's very important. And I also think it's strange because like we are the last generation that remembers growing up with life before the internet. Before cell phones and smartphones. And so the generation behind us, like the next generation, they're starting off with social media. Like I remember signing up for Facebook when it was just for college students. Yeah. Yeah. And like now like kids have Facebook when they're like
when they're 12. Born. When they're born, parents yeah. are creating accounts for them and then they inherit that account.
And like it's even crazier because you have like this weird privacy issue with parents putting photos of their kid. Like, obviously, you want to share photos of your child, like, on social media, but at what point does it become a violation of consent? Because this is a person who has never been able to say, please don't put my photo out. I don't like that picture.
I think that that is such a critical, critically important perspective. The conversation about technology and consent is a really important one. I mean, there's so much to unpack with the consent conversation. My brain is sort of spinning. I don't even know where to begin. But I do think I do think that allowing young people to decide for themselves how they want to be publicly represented mm-hmm. is beyond ethical and legal. It's the responsible thing to do if we are parents or caregivers or guardians. I always say usually before I speak to groups, and I do a lot of parenting talks too, is that any story I share about my kids, I've gotten their consent in advance for sharing. And that is true. I will not post anything. I will not write anything about my children unless I have told them what I'm going to do, why I'm going to do it, and they have the opportunity to say sure or absolutely not.
Right, so that they don't get embarrassed when they read any of your work later down the line, like, oh my God, I can't believe my mom posted this thing about me that's like now super public and like there's no way for me to divorce this information from myself.
Yeah, I saw a clip online through one of the feeds about what, you know, one of these super popular YouTube families mm-hmm. Who had posted a video and a whole conversation about the fact that their daughter was texting a boy, right?
Yeah, I think I saw that.
And I thought, First of all, you are inviting all of these people to comment on something that is a really typical part of development. And by the way, just because she was texting a boy doesn't mean anything about anything.
Right.
But I felt so badly.
Because now,
it's so unfair.
Now something that's like kind of embarrassing for this child, like as a part of growing up, has become up for public debate and discussion, and you have strangers giving you advice or telling you how to live your life. And it also is reinforcing this really weird narrative of toxic heteronormativity, where it's like, oh, you're texting a boy, obviously you're gonna like be trying to like hook up with this boy. And it's like, how do you even know I like boys? Like, did you even ask right. me that before I texted this kid? And if you did ask me, like, why are you putting it out on the internet, like, what my sexuality is as a child? Like,
this conversation,
even now,
this conversation around technology and how technology is like rapidly changing our experience with the world and how we interact with each other at such a rate that adults are still trying to figure out how we handle it and how we deal with it. And let alone, you know, what advice we can give to the younger generation and help them. We're all kind of reeling because not only is it changing fast, it's increasing at the speed that it's changing. And we're only now 10 years after the iPhone's been out, really having these conversations seriously in a way where we can try to like take stock of what's going on and try to change the conversation and give good advice on it. I almost wonder if we're in this weird like Wild West phase of like the beginning of sex ed when people were first like, maybe we should teach children about sex. But sex was something that we knew about as humans and was inherent to our human experience and was something that was a part of us. Here's this new technology that's like coming in from the outside. And it, like, how do we keep up with the speed of change? And do we need like a technology education course for teenagers in the same way that we have a sex education course that talks to them about, you know, it's okay. Like all this advice that you're giving right now, this is advice that people need to hear. And I don't think the teenagers are getting it because even the adults in the room don't know what to say.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, and I think you're right that this is the Wild West phase that because it's still new in the big picture. I went to college and we still had dial up and AOL right. and yeah. used to sit and wait and for you to be able to log in. I remember using a fax machine to send messages. God. You could fax through your computer back then.
Oh my God.
And then it would print out on your printer.
Yep.
clearly it's a long time ago, but everything is still so new. I think that developing technology skills and media literacy skills in general, and that by the way, includes, pornography literacy as part of that conversation, is really important. And certainly what I do when I teach is we spend a lot of time talking about different messages, that media, that culture, that politics give us about sex and sexuality, and to really think about how those messages might be helpful or not, right? And how do they shape who we are? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're positive, and sometimes they are absolutely not. The interesting thing with technology, and I think it's the almost the double-edged sword of finding communities that are like you, is that especially when you're young, you know, you're so desperately trying to figure out what your identity is. And once you have it, you feel so empowered by that. Mm-hmm. But as we know, people's individual trajectories, they don't always keep those labels, yeah. right? Sometimes we find ourselves in a different type of relationship, and all of a sudden we feel guilty about leaving that one community behind.
Right.
So, I mean, hopefully, you know, in these discussions, we can also talk about the fluidity of a lot of identities, and that just because you are where you are in this moment, I mean, yes. maybe you'll be there forever, but maybe you won't be. And that's not right. a judgment about you. That's yes. just part of human existence.
Yes.
That's so
it's
important.
Just a change. So I do actually want to ask you, like, I'm very curious what your perspective is on ethical non-monogamy and like yeah. how to introduce that to people of all ages, including like children.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, my take on monogamy in general is that when people ask me, and they have many times, do I think that monogamy is the default setting for all human beings? My answer is absolutely not. I mean, I don't think it is. I don't think it ever has been.
Right.
I think it's the way a lot of people structure their lives because the way society has been constructed has made that easier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. That being said, I think that it's our responsibility to talk to people of all ages, quite frankly, about the different types of family structures that exist. And it's not always about, well, it's certainly not always heterosexual,
right.
But that it also doesn't exist in monogamy either. There are so many different family structures. And in the end, families are about love. Families aren't about how many people are in them.
Right.
Mm. And it's clearly a super, can't even think of the word I'm looking for, but it's, our society here in the States is not necessarily how it is everywhere, or
exactly.
how it always has been.
It's not like universal.
For all of its issues. So I do think it's important for people to recognize that there are always options to partnerships. The one thing I have always told my adolescent students in particular is that it is absolutely okay to want to be with someone for a moment or a lifetime or a month or whatever mm-hmm. it is. As long as we are really upfront about our expectations before we engage in a relationship. And of course, that gets back to those vulnerable, awkward conversations.
Right.
Yes.
But I think that oftentimes we do things and cross our fingers that someone is going to like figure out what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really hard thing to mind read. So as long as we're all upfront and say and feel confident saying, you know, I want a relationship, or you know what, I'm not interested in a relationship.
Or you know what's even harder about being upfront is being honest with yourself as things are as you're changing. So within a relationship, maybe your feelings are changing or you want to try different things. And to then not just like do it on the side, but to actually be honest with yourself enough to be honest with your partner. Hey, this is how I'm feeling now. And it's okay that things are changing. And it can be really hard because you feel like you're hurting your partner maybe. But it's more important to be upfront and honest. What was the word you used the other? Was it radical honesty? Was it?
Radical candor.
Radical candor. I love that. I love that. You know, it's like, it's so important to really just expose yourself completely to somebody that you have developed an intimate relationship with and be able to be candid with them when things are changing, because it's always better to be upfront than to just allow somebody to find out through, you know, other means, which is infinitely more hurtful.
And that's part of the healthy relate. And again, I'm going to use relationship in quotations. We can use little r; it doesn't have to be a capital R. But you know that's part of the conversation to talk about needs and wants, and how to gracefully and respectfully talk to potential partners or when things are changing,
mm-hmm.
and how to do that in a way that validates not just who you are, but also who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are really, really hard to do because they're so deeply rooted in all of these hideous double standards that we have about gender and sexuality. And all of those things prevent us from speaking up for what we really want and what we really need.
Yeah.
It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah.
What do you think is like one conversation that people starting off a relationship, whether it be a couple or a throuple or whatever the case may be, what do you think is like one conversation that most partners should be having but somehow always miss?
Well, I'm not sure they always miss it, but they typically like miss it until it's too late.
Right.
Probably.
Skip it, like put it off or something. Yeah.
Deliberately ignore it. I think that probably a conversation about your personal deal breakers and non-negotiables.
Yeah.
We often assume that if we share certain values with someone that we're going to be values. On the same page with everything.
Yeah.
And oftentimes we're not. Now again, you know, to the earlier point, figuring out your deal breakers and non-negotiables means you actually have to think about what those are and really the tough questions around those. But it is doable. And I think I think regardless of the type of relationship structure you have, we often don't do that.
Right.
And again, because no one is a mind reader, no one's going to figure out that like, you know, this is my boundary on this issue unless I say it.
Right.
And there are always tactful ways of saying these things. And part of that is acknowledging that these conversations make us feel vulnerable. You know, mm-hmm. this is an uncomfortable conversation. I don't know how to bring this up, but I know that I care about you and I enjoy spending time with you. And I know this is important. So I'm going to push myself through it because it matters.
Yeah. I'm forever preaching about having strong, healthy boundaries and stating those boundaries and like protecting those boundaries and reiterating those boundaries. And like the first sign of a not healthy relationship is when someone is either willing to compromise their boundaries or when they are demanding that you compromise yours.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh yeah, oh no, oh no, my boundaries have been hard earned. Who are you? I spent years figuring this one out.
And like, this is why it's so important to be able to develop a healthy relationship with these types of conversations with your children, with your peer group, with your friends, so that because we never, like you said, we don't necessarily always know what our boundaries are. And sometimes you learn in ways that aren't very helpful that, oh, shoot, that really hurt me. And we don't always have the ability to talk to people about it and bounce those ideas off of somebody else and maybe get some feedback from an outside source. Like, you know what? It's totally fine that you're feeling this way and you should speak to your partner about it rather than just feeling like you should just, you know, deal with it and I need to be good for them so that I can stay with them. If you don't have this kind of conversational relationship with other people in your peer circle, you're not going to be able to figure these things out for yourself until it's too late. And then, you know, they end up materializing in the relationship in a really negative way. So again, conversation is just so important.
Yeah. And I think that it's one of my light criticisms about the way we've historically taught about consent. Mm-hmm. You know, we focused a lot on, again, historically, mm-hmm. on no means no. Instead of giving, I mean, yes, that's correct. Sure.
Yeah.
But there's also a piece of this, which is there's going to be a time where you want to say yes to something.
Right.
And how do you know when that is? And how do you know how to say yes in a yes. world that's told you to say no for so long?
Right.
Right. Especially growing up in an abstinence only or an abstinence only until marriage school system, you know, you're not taught those skills.
Right.
So being able to know when to say yes to something and how to say yes and how to validate that for yourself. But also this idea that conversations about consent and boundaries and desires are solely sexual, instead of really recognizing that we use the language and the scripts for consent all the time when we're young. You know, may I go to the bathroom? May I watch TV? You know, yep. Do you want to hang out on Friday night? Whatever it is, that's all part of having these conversations. But we put so much pressure on it.
Yes.
That we forget that we do this all the time and we learn to manage our feelings and our expectations. And sometimes we're delighted by someone's response. Sometimes we're not, and we're sad or frustrated or angry, and that sucks. But guess mm-hmm. what? You know, that's part of growing up.
That's healthy conversation and that's healthy relationship. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
Awesome. So you wrote a whole book about how to get your wife to have good sex with you. Yes. Like, I think this is a great, like, how to get your wife to have sex with you.
A good in bed guide.
That's so great.
Tell us about writing that book. What led to that coming about?
So that's a really good question. So a friend of mine is Dr. Ian Kerner, who wrote She Comes First. Mm-hmm. He is
How's that spelled? Should I ask?
I think I saw an interview where the two of you were talking about both of your books together.
Yes, talking about this. So he had created, he is now a sex and marital therapist, but he was working a lot in the sex and media and writing space, and he's terrific. And he had created this company called Good in Bed and was writing these digital guides. And we'd been friends for a long time and we're constantly doing the media circuit together. The two of us would show up on TV shows and offer, you know, different perspectives. And he said to me, do you want to write a digital guide called How to Get Your Wife to Have Sex with You? And I laughed out loud because it's so very particular. It's for a very particular audience. Like,
right.
I'm not pretending that it's, you know, inclusive of all relationships and identities.
Right.
Like it was a very targeted guide. And I have to say it was fun to write because it was a tongue-in-cheek, very personal, candid look at, you know, some of the challenges that emerge in long-term heterosexual sexual relationships. Mm-hmm. And also taking into account that there are things that we can blame on partners, but there's a lot that we can acknowledge that we bring to the table that make things slightly complicated. So it was definitely fun to write. You should know that if you saw the interview, right before the guide went live, I've married. I've been married for 20 years.
Congratulations. And my, that's amazing.
Thank you. 20 years and through a pandemic too.
So I'm just going to say that's just impressive. Yeah, yeah. Because this pandemic has actually been another decade. So you've actually been married for 30 years.
Amazing. So. I'm going to let him know. That counts too. So, you know, I remember right before it went live, and I have to say he is an amazing partner, and is, you know, it's not always easy being partnered for this long a period of time to the person who talks about sex for a living.
Like, right.
It comes with a lot of stuff. And he's handled it very, very gracefully. But I remember when the book was about to go live, he hadn't read it. And I said, I feel like a first person look at marital sex is probably something that you're going to want to read before it goes live. And he said to me, I will read it, but just so you know, if it does not work for me, I'm going to call the Today Show and tell them that you're a liar. And I said, that's okay. And the good news is he has not called the Today Show ever.
Yes.
Well, that's a glowing review right there. That should be on the book cover. My husband did not.
My husband read the guide and it worked. That's wonderful. So what do you think constitutes good sex? When you're talking about like a guide to good sex, what do you think constitutes good sex at, like for people to aspire to?
What constitutes good sex? I mean, you think I should have like just an answer ready to go, but there's so much to it. I think that part of good sex really just starts with recognizing who you are and what you want. I mean, we're so quick to rely on a partner to determine whether or not sex of any kind is good
right.
or not. Mm-hmm. But it's not really up to them, right? I mean, we know what feels good to us. We know what feels fulfilling. We're willing to communicate that. And, you know, we have to be willing to listen.
Right.
I don't think that people are bad. I think that people either listen and communicate well or they don't.
Right.
Right. Some people are selfish. Other people are not. If you are partnered with the selfish ones, it's probably time to get out.
yeah.
So I believe that good sex is about recognizing what you need to be fulfilled, and finding a way to respectfully translate that to someone else and put their needs on par with yours as well. That is obviously really hard thing to do.
Surprisingly.
And it shouldn't be, but I tell my students a lot that one of the, how did I phrase this? I've said to them something like the information, particularly about sexual pleasure for people who have vulvas and vaginas, is so limited, often incorrect.
Yeah.
Very poorly
studied.
It's through a male lens. It's through a fairly heterosexual lens. It doesn't really, you know, reflect what most of us experience or feel.
Right.
And the problem with that is that if those are our only paradigms for seeing sexuality and sexual pleasure, what happens is if our own personal experiences don't match that, what we've anticipated, you know, we do two things, right? We look at ourselves and say, I'm broken. There's clearly something wrong with me. Or, you know, we look at the person next to us and say, no, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
And neither of those are good options. And neither of those are correct.
Right. No, I completely agree. And I think that like, for me, I'm constantly talking about like, I guess I'm like the preachy one of my friends is like constantly talking about like boundaries and polyamory and like safe sex and like talking, like normalizing, talking about like getting tested and just sexual health in general. And I think it's just really interesting to see like how many people just kind of like, oh my God, you're talking about like something sex related. We did an episode on kink and it's just really funny to see how many people were just like, oh my God, they're talking about kink and I must see this like taboo episode.
So far though, it's been our most watched episode, which is really interesting because we haven't necessarily had a lot of conversations with people about it, but we noticed that people are really watching it.
Which is what you want. There's no one way to be a sexual being. And instead of looking at, and I say this loving Law and Order and Law and Order SVU. I will own that, but that's not the way we should learn about, you know, non-vanilla sexual lifestyles.
Oh, Lord, right. So right.
That's not the way to do it. So to have a platform and a forum where you can talk about BDSM, you know, kink with a capital K, yeah, polyamory and consensual non-monogamy is really important, because otherwise people are going to rely on mass media for those sources. Okay. And the information they get is going to be very limited.
Skewed. Yeah. My perspective, coming from a much more vanilla background, is that even if you're not interested or planning to go down that route of getting more kinky or really like opening up your sex life in a more elaborate way, simply knowing about what's out there and about other ways that people engage in loving relationships. We had the most amazing conversation. We're just finishing up this episode. We're going to put it out tonight with a Shibari expert from London. And I've only known about Shibari from a distance. You go to, you know, a photography museum or the Museum of Sex. They had a wonderful exhibit on Shibari, and you don't understand it just looking at photos. Talking to this gentleman about what got him into Shibari, he was talking about how the gay hookup scene was leaving him really unfulfilled, and he started engaging in kink and then eventually Shibari as an opportunity to slow down and have more intimate experiences, long drawn out intimate experiences with his partners. And that, to me, it just never crossed my mind that you know, what people are doing is they're developing additional languages to love each other. And that's what kink is about. It's not just about acting out some weird fantasies or like weird things in the back of your head that maybe you should feel guilty about even having those desires. That's kind of how it's portrayed in the mainstream media. It's like, oh, you know, maybe I'm attracted. I saw a porn once and that really turned me on, but that's disgusting. I can't admit to anybody that I was turned on by that. Rather than recognizing it, like, people are developing more elaborate languages, and you don't necessarily have to take them on, but knowing that they exist and knowing that you might come across a partner who may have some desires that are outside of those boundaries, and that it's okay to explore them together in a loving way, I think that that's so important to the conversation, just simply having it in your knowledge base.
Yeah. And there's I think we're so quick to talk about sex and focus on acts of, as opposed to talking about eroticism and sensuality and right, a lot of spirituality that's connected mm-hmm. with a sexual experience too. So yeah. It does not surprise me one bit that people would be interested in hearing about all of those things, because I think they are fascinating. And I think that we constantly want to figure out, you know, in part of the conversation about boundaries is, where are my boundaries? What are my options for boundaries? And you know, what is the type of partner that will allow me to feel safe and vulnerable in a way where I can test those boundaries mm-hmm. or not?
Yeah.
How has the sexual education, sexual knowledge world that you've been working in, how has that changed over the course of your career? How is it different today than when you first, you know, as a 15-year-old started getting involved learning about and talking about
So when I started in this field, as a teenager, it was obviously very targeted to the prevention of HIV,
right?
It was very focused on protection, and testing. Right. Which, by the way, is still an important part of conversations in the world of sexuality education.
Absolutely.
I think in a really beautiful way, we focus, for those of us who teach sexuality education, and I am certainly one of many, and there are lots of people from a variety of backgrounds and perspectives who also do this really beautifully. That we talk more about, you know, the different ways we identify ourselves, that before we talk about all of those like how-to stuff, mm-hmm. there's this expansive vocabulary about identity and gender and expression and relationships that we can be talking about. When I teach, you know, I often, if I'm hired by a school, I'll often tell them, you know, I'm not, you're never going to get me to just jump into talking about something like consent or healthy relationships without talking about the difference between sex and sexuality, assigned sex at birth, gender identity, gender roles, sexual orientation.
Do you get pushback on that in certain communities?
So, admittedly, no. I have to say I've been really, really lucky.
Okay.
No, I mean, that's great that they're at least willing to hear you out. Like, okay, well, if these are the terms and conditions, fine, we'll sign up.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, granted, being in New York City does help.
We're in a bubble.
I'm not going to pretend like it doesn't. I did have years ago. I had an experience where I taught this amazing sexuality education program at a single sex gender girls religious school who for 7 years, I mean, it was incredible. And then a parent actually of a kid that I did not teach became infuriated and sort of called the level above the head of the school. So called the organization,
the donors,
and then went, and I disappeared. But I have to say that was one out of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of experiences. But I've been incredibly lucky. And I think that part of that comes from developing after years of education or teaching a language to explain why these things are important and how they relate to everyone, regardless of what your political, religious affiliation may be. You know, it's not about any of those things. These are issues that we deal with throughout our lives. And, you know, if we're concerned about the health and well-being of future adults, then it starts now.
That is so wonderful. And that's why it is so important that people like you are doing this work, and you are spending the years and the time and you know, building the relationship with people and understanding people and developing the languages to be able to explain this to people who, for them, it may be a completely foreign concept why this is important. But yet we still need to break through to people like that, because it is people and communities like that that maybe need this kind of education and conversation more than anyone else. So that's so wonderful. It's so wonderful to hear that that's been your experience, and you know, that you're going to continue doing that work and you know, sharing your knowledge with people and coming on our show and doing it here. So we really appreciate that and your wonderful books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. I mean, it's a real privilege to be able to, you know, have access to communities and provide them, you know, be a direct source for information about sex and sexuality, and also being able to recognize that the question that you asked about how has sex ed changed? I mean, we didn't talk in expansive terms about gender and identity years ago. Even 5 to 10 years ago.
Didn't even know how important it was then, though. You know what I mean? I feel like our own knowledge is just so rapidly expanding.
I mean, I think the people who were most affected by it knew how important it was. Yeah. But like the social construct at large didn't seem to know the conversation.
Right. And from an administrative perspective in schools and organizations, it would have been hard to get buy-in from people, but we recognize that there's a human rights element to all of this. And we should have never stuck our heads in the sand, but we cannot, we should not do that. And mass media has changed too, right? I mean, regardless of whether you like RuPaul's Drag Race, the fact is that, you know, identity and expression and gender roles are now in our mainstream vernacular. It is super cool to be working with elementary school students who can name every queen on, you know, the latest season of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Amazing.
That's so cute.
Because it's certainly not the education that I got. And I did not grow up in a conservative environment by any stretch of the imagination, but we just didn't have that mass media diversity available to us. And now they do.
So as one like last question, I wanted to ask you if there is one way that you think, or maybe not one, but if you think there is a way that we could start fixing sex education in America, like what steps do you think that we should, like the baseline steps that we should start with, and like where we should go to start normalizing and fixing sex education to make it more expansive across
getting closer
the state.
To the experience that you're bringing to the table here in New York.
Right.
So I'm so glad you said not one thing, because you clearly know by now that I'm way too verbose and I can't talk.
Yeah, not one thing at all. There's no one fix to our education system.
I mean, we've got all day.
So one of our biggest challenges as in the community, in terms of school-based sex ed, we'll just start there, because I think that's where most young people are being impacted, either by crappy sex ed or non-existent sex ed,
right?
Is that most parents and caregivers and guardians have actually no idea what their schools are doing. They think they know what they're doing, but they don't really know what the content is, what the agenda may or may not be, who's teaching, what their experience is in teaching. I mean, I would rather people have no sex ed than be taught by someone, you know, who has no background in talking about sexuality and development with young people, because it could be so scarring to someone.
Or has never even had sex themselves. Yeah. In some cases.
I mean, I always laugh when I tell people, like, I am not the gym teacher. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with a PE teacher teaching sex ed. Right. If they've been trained to teach sex ed.
Yes.
But sexuality educators know that we are in general a very underrated profession. People don't absolutely seem to care that much about us, even though we do a lot of really important work and on all different levels. So first step, know what's going on in your respective community. Mm-hmm. And parents and caregivers have a lot of power locally in terms of pushing school boards and agendas and making sure things get done. Mm-hmm. And also just pairing up with organizations and people in your communities who provide the best allyship. It is unconscionable to think that the laws pertaining to sex ed in this country are so batshit. have states who, we don't even have a universal law saying that sex ed has to be medically and factually accurate.
Right.
You
would think so the baseline. You would think that would just be the baseline.
Like going into a history class and just lying, making up facts and saying, okay, that's your history. But equally as bad, it's about bodies, right? It's about bodies and identity. And now I'm going to lie about it. So we have that, which is a problem. And then of course there's no universal strategy for teaching sex ed, even though there are incredible organizations and lobbyists looking to provide comprehensive sexuality education across the board. But we still have programs that are fundamentally, abstinence only focused, super heterosexist, have these grotesque racist underpinnings to them, just homophobic, transphobic, the
absolutely
works. So it's important that people figure out what's actually being taught, and then finding the organizations and the people in their communities who can help them fight the good fight.
Do you have examples of who those organizations would be?
Yeah. So off the top of my head, Advocates for Youth is an amazing organization. They are DC based. They have incredible youth activists, but they also have a lot of people working to help school boards, help empower students and parents to get the education that they need. So that's just one off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. And they have amazing resources on their websites. And they actually also have something called amaze.org, which is it's a site full of these amazing short form sex ed videos for people of all ages everything, including not just gender identity and healthy relationships and condoms, but virginity and what virginity is really about, what it means to have an abortion, emergency contraception, some really awesome, awesome videos.
That's amazing. Great.
Masturbation. And again, you can check them out. They can always supplement the information people are giving at home or at schools too.
If a parent wanted to just Google some generic terms to be able to find organizations like this in their local community, what terms should they be Googling?
So I would say Advocates for Youth would definitely be the first source, and to go from there, because there's a lot of information that will steer people to local areas. SIECUS is another one, SIECUS, which stands for the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States.
Awesome.
And both of those sources have lots of information and strategies for how to get what you need out of your sex ed program.
Amazing.
Oh my God. Perfect. Well, this has been such a fantastic conversation. I feel like I could just talk to you for hours about
I still have so many questions. We could have done this for 3 hours. We are getting overrun in New York City by the storm of the decade, they say. You have children to pick up from school, I'm sure. So we thank you so much for taking the time on this snowy Wednesday in December to chat with us. And we'll have to do this again sometime, because next time after pandemic, we're going to get you here in the studio so we can do this in person.
Amazing. Would love to. Thank you so much for having me. See, I mean, Twitter can be a cesspool for a lot of things, but clearly some good things come from
there. There is so much magic on Twitter, and that, yeah, we're so thankful again that you're able to take the time to come in and talk to us. And yeah, we will be following your work and plugging your work and retweeting your work on Twitter as well. And we'll be linking everything in the description for the show so that people can check out your books, check out your Twitter, and all of these wonderful resources that we've been talking about. So thank you again, Dr. Lefkoff.
Well, thank you.
Have a wonderful rest of your day. Enjoy.
Be safe and well and survive the last few months of the pandemic. We're almost there.
I know. There's a light at the end of this tunnel. Like, oh. Although I have to wear pants again. So, I mean, that's going to be a problem.
I don't know about that. I don't know.
No problem. All right. Thanks again.
Take care. Thanks again.
Ciao.
Bye.
Thanks for checking out this clip from our show.
To watch more clips or full episodes, click on our profile below.
If you want to stay up to date on all of our new episodes and videos, click subscribe.
And if you have any ideas for future guests or topics that you would like to see us cover on the show,
leave us a message in the comments or connect with us on any of our social media channels at Funtime Program.
Or on our website at funtimeprogram.com.
We'll see you in the next one.
Bye-bye.